A new season of Bridgerton is here. And with it, a new season of Bridgerton, the official podcast. I'm your host, Gabby Collins. And this season, we are bringing fans even deeper into the ton. Watch season 3 of the Shondaland series on Netflix. Then fall in love all over again by listening to Bridgerton, the official podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe to catch a new episode every Thursday.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher, back with another season of the global number one podcast, The Girlfriends. Last time, we investigated the murder of Gail Katz. This time, we're uncovering the identity of the woman who was buried in Gail's grave for a decade before she disappeared. Join me and the rest of the club as we tell her story. Listen to season 2 of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Michael Rappaport.
And I'm Kibi Rappaport.
And together we're hosting Rappaport's Reality Podcast.
We have a passion for reality TV, and we're inviting you into our living room.
We're dissecting the drama, and we're giving praise to the single greatest form of entertainment on television today. That is right. Reality TV is the greatest form of entertainment on television today.
Listen to Rappaport's Reality with me, Kibi Rappaport.
And me, Michael Rappaport, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcast.
Welcome to Movie Crush, a production of iHeartRadio. Hey, everybody, and welcome to Movie Crush Friday Interview Edition. And folks, this is a real treat because something special is happening today. We have in his own home studio our new-ish producer, Seth Johnson, who I don't even really know aside from emailing. This is the first time I've seen your face.
Yeah. Hello.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. Happy to be here. It's a pleasure. I genuinely love this show, so it's been great to work on it. And I was very excited when you asked me to be a guest. So here I am. Let's do this.
Yeah, man. I mean, this is something that I was wanting to do anyway, because I thought it would be a fun way to get to know you and for the listeners to get to know you and for you to become more a part of the show. And then I also, you know how kind of close we've been playing it these days. I looked up and I was like, oh my God, I don't have anything ready for Friday. And I said, this might be the perfect time. And you stepped right in. So I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Happy to do it.
Before we get going on the movie, I thought, we should get to know each other a little bit. I don't even know anything about you. I don't know where you're from or what your story is. So where are you from?
Born in Eugene, Oregon. I'm from the Pacific Northwest.
Nice.
And then I moved around a lot as a youth. Mm-hmm. So I've lived basically everywhere on the West Coast.
Okay.
So I lived in Portland for a while, lived up by Seattle, lived in a town called Spokane for a while. Uh-huh. Then I moved down to Los Angeles, lived there for a while. And then I moved here probably when I was, 30-ish, maybe like 5 or more years ago. I don't know, a while ago. But I basically, here's a very long story short. You ready?
Yeah.
Okay. Childhood in Oregon. Mm-hmm. Teenage/high school years in Washington.
Okay.
20s and whatnot in Los Angeles. And now I've been spending my 30s here in Atlanta. That's a very quick version of that.
What years were you in Los Angeles?
That would have been around 2008-ish until, who knows, maybe 2015, 2016, something like that.
Okay. I was wondering if we had any overlap, but I left LA in like 2004, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I've heard glimmerings of your stories through podcasting you've done. Do you miss it at all? Because my wife misses it like crazy. She wants to move back all the time.
Oh, really? I don't miss living in LA. I certainly, I ended up back in Atlanta where I'm from after many, many years of about 20 years of being away. And so this is it for us. But I do love to visit LA, and I have a lot of really good friends in LA. And I miss visiting LA, of course, right now more than ever.
Right.
But where did you guys live out there?
Let's see. We lived in East Hollywood when I first got there.
All right. Like Los Feliz or?
Oh, no, nowhere as fancy as that. Like, real dirt East Hollywood. Like the kind of place where you wake up and someone has siphoned your gas tank. Uh-huh. You know, that kind of East Hollywood. And it was all right. And then we lived there for a while. My wife and I got married while we were still living down there. And then uh-huh. moved into our own place in more like the, the Palms region, kind of near like Culver City, that zone. Mm-hmm. Then we lived there for a while, and that was wonderful. There's, as I'm sure, there's a lot of great things about living in that city,
sure.
Especially if you're there for the entertainment industry, which was why I was there. I've been working before my podcasting career recently. Uh-huh. I worked as an animator for 10 or 15 years. So that's actually part of why I ended up in Atlanta, was for more animation work.
Wow. Now tell me about animation. Like what was your history there? What did you work on?
Lots of things you've heard of and lots of things you haven't heard of. Okay. for example, my most famous shows that I worked on would be Archer, Aqua Teen Hunger Force, oh, yeah. Squidbillies, Fargo, Legion. Most recently, I did a whole bunch of stuff on that new show, Cake. I have many.
Oh, cool.
Little the stuff with your friend John Hodgman on there.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's a wonderful show, and I really love all the things that contributed to that. And the way the system works, I still have a movie coming out next year. Uh-huh. And let's see here, what else do I have? Oh, and one more superhero themed TV show coming out on FXX at some point in the future, but who knows.
That's awesome. Now what did you do? I mean, were you drawing stuff?
That's how it started. I uh-huh. started as an animator and did whatever anyone asked of me, and yeah. then you move up, you become a lead, and when I left, I was the director of short form programming, and that's why I was working on Cake. Mm-hmm. And even as a director, you're still doing a lot of drawing. I was still doing lots and lots of animation, even as a director towards the end.
Now, what brought the career change over to podcasting, and how did you come by us?
It did a couple of things. One, I'm sure many people have experienced this in whatever field they're in, but you reach a certain age and you look around and you mm-hmm. realize that everyone around you is just getting younger and younger. And
yeah.
perhaps this isn't the kind of career path where you want to grow old in, you know? And that's, of course, no offense to anyone who has made an amazing career in animation. But I noticed for myself when I reached a certain plateau where mm-hmm. I was like, oh, I did it. I did it. I reached the top. I'm very happy. And I guess there's nowhere else to go if I'm going to be living in Atlanta
right.
and doing this life. I guess I'm done. And so it just felt very natural just to be like, well, I've accomplished what I wanted to accomplish uh-huh. and I'm done now. And very, very luckily, I'm the kind of guy where I do something for free for a decade uh-huh. and then someone eventually offers me to do it for money,
yeah.
and then it becomes a career. That's how I became an animator,
uh-huh.
and then that's how I became a podcaster. Because the whole time I was working as an animator, I did a bunch of independent podcasts on my own time,
uh-huh.
and then a buddy of mine, who I'm sure you know, Ahow, aka Andrew Howard.
Andrew Howard.
Yeah. He works at the studio. Okay. Ahow produces. Let's see, Sminty. He produces Saber and a couple other shows.
All right.
Yeah. But he's a wonderful dude. And he said to me one day, hey, my boss, Jerry, is looking for some new audio producers. I know you've been doing this for a decade on your own. You uh-huh. want to come do it for real? And I'm like, yeah, why not? And so I popped over just on a whim. And it's been so much fun. I've been doing this with you guys for about a year and a half now. And I love it.
Yeah.
Great world.
Now that I see you, I have noticed your face around the office, but I feel like there were always, I can't even picture Andrew in my head, but I know I'd kick myself if I did see him.
Oh, I mean, it's all these people in the office that when we all end up going back, I'm uh-huh. just not going to recognize them anymore. all of our hair will all be grown out. And yeah.
Now, how have you enjoyed the transition to the audio side? Is it fulfilling? Is it more or less challenging?
Honestly, I love most of all how easy it is to get something on the air.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
speed.
Like, I'm sure as you know too from living in Los Angeles, you have the world's best projects mm-hmm. that have everything going for them. And then one little thing goes wrong and then millions and millions of dollars are gone.
Yeah.
You know? And I'm debating whether or not I should give you specific funny examples towards the end of my animation career. I'll give you one. Okay. This one's very, very public. Okay. I was working on a pilot for a show about these two police officers. They got these two stand-up comedians to play these two police officers, just legends in their field, doing their thing. You can probably see where I'm going with this.
Yeah.
And it was starring Albert Brooks and Louis C.K.
Oh, wow.
And it was a wonderful show. I really, really enjoyed it. Albert Brooks is, of course, legend among legends. He's the greatest.
Yeah, yeah.
And the show got picked up. It was going to be airing on TBS. And right in the middle of the production, Louis C.K. got in a lot of trouble, rightfully so.
Yeah.
Yeah. And therefore, the entire show, the entire production, completely out the window. You can Google this. You can still find like still shots on the internet of them getting ready to promote this show. And it's just never going to happen, you know, period. Jeez. That's it.
Did you
years?
Did you complete episodes and everything?
Yeah, 100%.
Were they great?
Yeah. No, I loved it. I absolutely loved it. Mostly because I love Albert Brooks. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then another one too. I debate saying this stuff out loud, but when it reaches like the public sphere, I believe you can talk about it. The other one is myself and my a bunch of my friends, my coworkers. We were working on that Donald Glover Deadpool animated series.
Oh, yeah.
The one that was getting all kinds of hype and everything. Some of my favorite animation I've ever done was for the pilot for that.
Uh-huh.
And no one will ever see it. Ever.
It's heartbreaking.
So that kind of stuff, like the fact that I spent, I don't know, 15 years as an animator and maybe seven of it actually made it to fruition.
Yeah. Yeah. Podcasting is very quick. Like you said, I mean, obviously the no brainer example is we're recording this on a Wednesday. It's out on Friday.
Yes.
But you can also get a show going. And if it's a easy lift in a matter of weeks, if you want to.
Oh yeah. No. I mean, again, as an animator, there are shows that I pitched when I was, maybe 6 years in, and I'd be like pushing it for like half a decade. Mm-hmm. And then you get real close, then it falls away, and real close, then it falls away. I know you're close with John Hodgman. Do you know Jesse Thorne as well?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Jesse's a good friend.
Me and Jesse had an animated series we were pitching together, and it was so good. I loved it more than anything. It was me, Jesse, and Jordan.
So cool.
It was the greatest. And it was just bad timing. Multiple times, bad timing. Just it never connected. And you know, what can you do?
Yeah, it's heartbreaking. It's like I used to want to write movies, and I still dabble in that stuff sometimes just for fun, but it's like, why would anyone want to get involved in that business? It's just heartbreak after heartbreak, and it's rare that anyone breaks through at all. And even when you do, like, I have plenty of friends who write for TV and stuff that you think, all right, well, I got a job writing on television. I'm set as a writer. And that's just not the case. It's always just, you're always scrapping unless you really get to a certain point where you're always working or you're always someone's first or second call and sought out. But otherwise, it's just a grind, man. Even actors just auditioning and getting constantly rejected. It's brutal. Why does anyone even want to do it?
And the finish line, it doesn't exist either. Like I used to feel when I was younger that I'm like, oh man, when I reach these certain hallmarks, like for example, when I was working on Archer, super duper proud of it. I won my first Emmy and I was so happy. I was like, wow, I did it. Like, this is like the pinnacle, right? Uh-huh. Everyone. And no, nothing. You know what I mean? Like, you still don't get like residuals as an animator. You don't like, you know, suddenly get like a big pay boost. You're still working for like, you know, a cable evening TV show. There is no end point.
Yeah.
Like, as soon as the show that you are so proud of happens, it ends.
You're unemployed.
And then you start over. Yeah, exactly.
What, you never could get Jesse on Archer? I know that's kind of a running joke for him. A real dream.
Oh, yeah. No, I tried. I absolutely tried. That's definitely how Jesse and I first met, was I drew some fan art of John Hodgman because John had ruled on a case of mine for Judge John Hodgman.
Oh, like you were an actual litigant, or was it a quick one?
I was a litigant.
Oh, cool. And, which one was it?
He actually wrote it up for one of his New Yorker magazine ones. And I lost. It was, I love music more than anything. And so I have an absolutely astronomical sized music collection. I like to just have it out on display so I can grab from it whatever I want. My wife wanted to move it to the basement, and the Honorable Judge John Hodgman decreed that I had to move my collection to the basement, which is where it is. So
interesting. I wonder, were you the one who set precedent of his now multiple rulings on collections? I can't remember how he words it, but it's like, if you actually display it, then it's a collection. If you don't display it, then I don't think he calls it hoarding, but
yeah, something about like being in use or not in use or something like that. I'm sure there've been many cases that have followed down the same, same path. But so yeah, I drew some fan art of Judge John Hodgman. Jesse Thorne contacted me and was like, "Oh, hey, I love this image. Can I use this on like a poster?" I'm like, "Oh, of course, of course." And I was like, "Oh, and by the way, I work on the show Archer, and we appreciate how often you talk about the show." And he was like, "Really? I love Archer. Can I be a voice?"
That's like, great.
And I've tried. I've tried, but it's never come up.
Oh, I hope it happens for him. He's actually going to be on next week, so you'll be hearing Jesse. Nice. We're going to record next Wednesday.
Nice. He's a great dude. I love Jesse Thorne for every reason in the world.
Yeah, he's a good guy. I just finished listening to his Bullseye interview with David Letterman today.
Yes, me too.
Which, boy, man, it was so good. I don't know if you heard it yet.
Yeah, it's wonderful. And just, I don't know, like I feel Jesse's excitement when he lands an interview like that. I know. You know?
It's pretty great, but he still manages to be a professional, whereas I mean, I'm not a professional interviewer. I do all the wrong things by gushing and telling people how much I love them and all the things you're not supposed to do. But they're conversations on my end. Jesse's a pro. He's a real pro.
Oh, he's, I mean, I wouldn't even call myself a friend of his. He and I worked on a project once. So I feel free to gush and be very excited about Jesse Thorne. He's one of the best interviewers I've ever listened to. He's so good, but like just not only making the guest feel comfortable, making them feel like appreciated, you know, like so many times. Yeah.
Yeah. It's really, really great. I love that series he did. I can't remember what he called it, but where he was interviewing other, interviewers.
Yes. I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
That was really very insightful stuff. Also, before we get going too, want to talk to you a little bit about, Noel kind of gave me a little insider thing that you actually cut and make vinyl LPs yourself?
I do.
How do you do that?
Technically, what I do is lathe embossing, which is slightly different from cutting.
Okay.
But yeah, no, it's all, I make records. I run a small record label, and I'm in the room right now where I do it. I'm looking at the machine over there. basically, I'm sure you know this as a musician and as a person who likes music. When you go to get a real vinyl record pressed at a vinyl pressing plant, it costs so much, you know, mostly it's because you have to make that stamp, you know, that has like the two record sides on it. So when you're pressing that vinyl, you got to like make the cost of creating this giant stamp worthwhile, more or less.
Yeah.
So you need to order at least 300 to 500 copies of this record, and you have to wait like 3 months for it to get back to you and all this stuff. And just like that barrier of entry for musicians is just too much.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know about you, but 99.99% of the musicians I know, we're unpopular.
Yeah.
We do it for fun, and it's not because it's a moneymaker, it's because it's a great time, you know?
Right.
And so I wanted to find an option that could let an artist release one or two records if they wanted to, or you know, 10, 50, whatever, anything less than 300. And so yeah, I bought a machine. It's one of those very old-timey like my machine's like 100 years old.
Wow.
Back in like the 1920s, 1930s, like the radio days, what they would do is, you know, if they had to rebroadcast something either for a later time, or if they had to, you know, send it overseas for like a an army radio station or something, they would make these quick records that sound terrible, honestly. Like that's what they would make them for. And just they have something, some duplication device. And those machines obviously went became obsolete when, like, you know, reel-to-reels and then later digital files and all that came into play. So people just started going out there and buying up these machines wherever they could and turning them into basically their own home mini record pressing plants.
Wow.
And that's what I do now. And it's so much fun. And it's just great to be able to help artists because, you know, really famous popular artists don't need the help. They're fine. You know, if they can afford to make 500 copies of a record, they're obviously doing just fine on their own.
Yeah,
I get to support all the artists who have zero fans, you know, and yeah. and have zero money and just like, oh, hey, can I make 50 copies? Because I really, really, really want just this one scene to know that I've made a physical record that I'm so proud of. I'm like, absolutely, let's do it. You know, wow. and it's great. I love it.
That is so cool. So someone records something. I mean, how does that process work?
In a nutshell, it goes like this. Basically, my machine, it goes through a couple of, you know, like a little daisy chain of electronics down into a little one eighth inch headphone jack.
Okay.
You know, like, yeah. And basically, you can turn that into, you know, a guitar cable. You can turn it into whatever you want. Uh-huh. And you just, whatever you put into there, it will then go through a system. It's just like a graphic equalizer and like a preamp. And then it just goes into a little magnet thingamajig that has a little ruby stylus
okay.
that you press into a thing. And then it's got a little, you know, a gear thing and it moves across the record and it embosses the song through vibration into it. And it's really simple. Uh-huh. But then like the hard part is just trying to make it sound good. you know, like to get it to work isn't that difficult. To make it sound good is nearly impossible. And that's the fun part, you know, is to like kind of fight the machinery and fight the music and find a way that it works.
That is so cool. Well, when the end times are over, I'm going to invite myself over to see this in person.
Absolutely. If that's anytime. Okay. It's 100%. It's just a grand old time. And I know you make music too. So if there's anything you feel like doing, just let me know. Cause it's great to just kick out something just for your own collection too. I've had friends who have like, I've had a couple of really sweet things where like a friend of mine, he, had a recording of his wife's, ultrasound and then he has sound from her birth and then he has sound from like her first words.
Wow.
He edited them all together. I put it on a record for him and he gave it to his wife as an anniversary present. Stuff like that is just
interesting.
Wonderful.
All right, that gives me some ideas then.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, anyway, very cool. I guess I'll plug it anyway. Go to hauntedbirthday.com. That's my record label. If anyone feels like checking it out, it's fun
stuff. In fact, I'm going to put that in my computer right now and check it out later. I have a little side story to that. My mom, grew up in Memphis, Tennessee, and she, before Sun Studios, it was the Memphis Recording Company, I think it was called, and you could come in off the street and record something. And my mom played, I think, a saxophone maybe when she was a kid, and my granddad took her in there, and she actually cut a record at what would become Sun Records later on when it was the Memphis Recording Studio or I don't know if I'm getting that name right, but it's a very cool little story. And she doesn't have the record. I wish she did. That'd be awesome.
It's the technology is not too dissimilar even from, you ever been to a Third Man Records up in Nashville?
Yeah, I did go in there and I wanted to record something, but I got nervous and didn't.
but the technology of their record your own record booth in their little like gift shop, the technology is not too dissimilar from that.
Yeah. It made me want to buy those booths.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Well, that's so cool, man. I love that. Where do you guys live here in Atlanta?
Kind of near East Atlanta Village.
Okay. Yeah, you're not far. I'm in Eastlake. You got kids?
No. I have my wife and I who've been together for a very long time. But no, we have no children nor plans for children.
All right. Well, that's the right way to do it. No, I love my daughter, but I get it. You can't make your own records when you got a kid around.
Yes, that's true.
Well, that's cool, man. It's good to meet you. And we're going to talk a little bit about Scott Pilgrim versus the World. You sent over a kind of a quick list, Hard Day's Night, which I actually already did on the show with Ken Jennings, pre you. And the other one, how do you pronounce the other movie?
Koyaanisqatsi.
Right. I didn't know anything about that. And I'm definitely going to watch that after I did a little bit of research on it. It looks very, very cool.
Oh, yeah. And the whole trilogy is good, too. Koyaanisqatsi, Powakatsi, and Nakoikatsi. All three of them are wonderful. I love them. I know you're a big music guy too, and it's basically watching the world's best visualizer for a Philip Glass album.
Yeah.
That's what it is.
I'm all over
and
that.
It actually turned into a game amongst my friends and I where we just called it Katsi, where we were so excited just to listen to music all the time.
Uh-huh.
But you kind of don't want to just like sit in a chair and stare at each other when you listen to music.
Yeah.
So you turn on the TV and mute it, and then you listen to albums and you wait for it to sync up.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I used to do games like that. There was generally a bong involved as well.
Yes, of course, of course. It's the social lubricant in that situation.
Yeah, that's awesome. I do want to see that. Yeah, I watched the trailer for it, and it looks right at my alley. And now it's a bit of a time capsule as well, which is kind of cool.
Yes, for sure, for sure.
A new season of Bridgerton is here. And with it, a new season of Bridgerton, the official podcast. I'm your host, Gabrielle Collins, and this season, we are bringing fans even deeper into the ton. Colin Bridgerton has returned from his travels abroad. Is betrothal written in the stars for the eligible bachelor? Meanwhile, the ton is reverberating with speculation of who holds Lady Whistledown's pen. We're discussing it all. I sit down with Nicola Coughlin, Luke Newton, Shonda Rhimes, and more to offer an exclusive peek behind the scenes of each episode of the new season. Watch season 3 of the Shondaland series on Netflix. Then, fall in love all over again by listening to Bridgerton, the official podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe to catch a new episode every Thursday.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher. I'm so excited to tell you about the brand new series of The Girlfriends. In season 1, we told you about the murder of Gail Katz at the hands of my ex-boyfriend, Bob. At one point, a woman's torso washed up on Staten Island and was misidentified as Gail. She spent 9 years in Gail's grave, and then she just disappeared.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
And that's what we're going to do. Find this missing girlfriend and tell her story. With the help of some of your favorite girlfriends from season 1, like my producer, Anna.
Oh my God.
My friend, Dr. Mindy Shapiro.
Hi, it's Dr. Shapiro, and I'd like to speak with the deputy medical examiner.
And of course, Gail's sister, Elaine Katz.
Having no closure, it kills you.
Join us as we try to solve a 35-year-old cold case. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be one hell of a ride.
What?
I can't believe this.
Listen to season 2 of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Elliot Connie, and this is Family Therapy.
My best hopes, I guess, identify the life that I want and work towards it.
I never seen a man take care of my mother the way she needed to be taken care of.
I get the impression that you don't feel like you've done everything right as a father. Is that true?
That's true. And I'm not offended by that.
Thank you for going through those things, and thank you for overcoming them.
Thank God for the limits.
Every time I have one of our sessions be positive. It just keeps me going.
I feel like my focus is redirected in a different aspect of my life now.
So, how'd we do today?
We did good.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy. Listen now on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
But Scott Pilgrim versus the World, a movie that is hard to believe is 10 years old, that I really loved and saw it. Watching it again today, I really was mad that I never got to see this in the movie theater. I think I came on a little bit late and saw it when it came out on DVD or maybe even a streaming service. And my wife and I both loved it. And I think I saw it a couple of times back then. But this seems like a movie that would have been a lot of fun to see in a theater. From the great Edgar Wright. What's your history with this movie? How did you come about it?
I definitely remember seeing it in theaters, and you are correct in that I bet it would have been fun to see with an audience, but I did not because I saw it in theaters.
It didn't perform that well, did it?
No, which still to this moment astonishes me. Yeah. I don't understand that in the least. I was really excited for it. I had read the comics, and I obviously was a big fan of everyone involved as an actor, but I was also really, really excited about the music involved.
Yeah.
Like I'd heard that Beck was writing the music for Sex Bob-omb and that Metric was writing.
I didn't know he did.
Oh yeah. No, here. So I'll throw down a few, deeper music things in this. So all of the Sexbomb songs were written by Beck.
Okay.
And that's kind of why they're so good.
Yeah. You know? I mean, this movie wouldn't have worked if they weren't really good songs.
Exactly. And then the Clash at Demon Head, all of their songs were written by Metric.
Okay.
And then Crash and the Boys, all their songs were written by Broken Social Scene.
Oh, yeah.
And so I had heard about that. And so that's initially what drew me in. And I saw how good the soundtrack was. And I was like, all right, obviously this is going to be good if they're putting this kind of effort and energy into the soundtrack, you know? So yeah, me and my friends went and saw it. And man, I still remember. So there's the opening Universal logo with like the 8-bit. And that's real cool and fun.
Yeah, that is awesome.
And then when they start playing that very first song and you see Knives Chow's face of just like pure bliss and discovery, and the room kind of falls back and the lightning bolts are coming off, and
so
then
great.
It goes into this beautiful animated sequence for the opening credits. Like I just felt chills all over my body, and like, oh, I'm experiencing something incredible for the first time right now, and I'm realizing how good it is in the moment. I'm so happy right now, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it's really a movie unlike any other. I think it's I was sort of trying to categorize it, and here's what I came up with is a comic book, fantasy, video game, martial arts, romantic comedy. Yes. It's sort of all those things, and it wouldn't have worked if it hadn't have been funny. It wouldn't have worked if there hadn't have been a great love story at the heart of it. And it's also a hero's journey. It wouldn't have worked as well if the martial arts scenes weren't so fucking amazing. All the video game, and it's maybe the most comic booky comic book movie I've ever seen too. Like they really nailed it.
And they succeeded. So many people have tried, but they really succeeded in making it feel like a comic book with all the graphic flourishments and just like the action and the way the shots kind of progress the storyline, like with their visual, you know, like where it mirrors what a comic panel would do, but in a completely different medium, which is just astonishing that he accomplished it, you know?
Yeah. Like I'm trying to, like, this is a movie that is very much built in an edit room, but it's also a movie that I can't imagine how meticulously it was storyboarded.
Right.
It's not a movie where you just, you know, you shoot your wide and you shoot your over the shoulders and you get your coverage and move on. Like I imagine Edgar Wright was very, very specific and how like everything, how one shot went to another, and even little small shots like that one where Scott just twirls around and all of a sudden it's not him, but it's who's the lead singer? Steven Stills, which is pretty funny. Like just little things like that. It just, everything married together so well, that the split screens and all the different stuff that looks like a comic book page. It's just so lively and energetic, and like all his movies are that, but this one really just like is an assault on the senses in all the right way, I think.
Oh, for sure. And to what you're saying, here's what I've heard about Edgar Wright. Obviously, I don't know the man. Who knows? But from what I've heard is that he likes to plan his animatics down to the millisecond, you know, because that's the way he gets his like music just right.
Yeah.
And then he breaks down everything from his animatics into just a shopping list.
Right.
And then he says, at least for him, that it's not too difficult to film a movie because he already knows exactly what he's looking for. So like the big question to him is, did I get it or did I not get it? And that's it. You know, it's just a shopping list. And from what I've heard, that was very valuable when he was making Baby Driver.
Yeah,
because
I'm sure.
So reliant on hitting these musical beats and having these moments.
So exact. Exactly.
And I think I would assume that he learned a lot about syncing music to scene to telling a story from Scott Pilgrim that he used in Baby Driver.
No, absolutely. You can, I mean, the movies aren't really anything alike, but the DNA is there, and it's for sure like a 1.0 version of what Baby Driver would become as far as syncing and marrying music to film, like I'd never seen before in Baby Driver.
Yes, but, for sure.
I know Nigel Godrich actually worked on, did he do the score for this?
He did. He did the score and he was the executive music producer. So, okay. I mean, like, that's astonishing. I mean, obviously he's got all kinds of cred from his Radiohead production stuff and whatnot, but also, him as a musician, he's got this really amazing band called Ultra Ista that I love. So like it's great when you see people who don't get the credit for being a musician get these huge like gigs, like, whoa, check it out. Look at your score. And, I also love how often Nintendo themes are woven into the score.
It's pretty fun.
It feels so good. From what I heard, basically, Edgar Wright had to write to Nintendo and wrote this big gushing letter about how the Nintendo songs from Legend of Zelda specifically, but also Mario and Tetris and et cetera, they are the lullaby of this generation.
Yeah.
And without that kind of like glue to like bind things together, mm-hmm. you felt like the story would be false.
Yeah.
And Nintendo, to their credit, was like, absolutely, go for it.
Totally. It's great for them. I mean, he could have, I'm sure they could have written some stuff that would have subbed in nicely, but there's something about using those real music stings, like you said, that everyone is so familiar with. Like, it really hit a generation in just the right way. And then, you know, the songs, the needle drops on some of these songs, too, from other artists. Some of my favorite artists, like the perfection of I Heard Ramona Sing from Frank Black and Beachwood Sparks, who was one of my favorite bands when I lived in L.A. That's when they were big. Saw them a couple of times back then. And that cover of Sade's By Your Side is, you know, I was waiting for someone to use that in a movie. And someone finally did. And Beachwood Sparks got a little recognition. And they were a pretty small, you know, fairly regional band, I feel like, in that Southern California scene back in the early 2000s. But just love seeing them get a little love in this movie, too.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And one of my favorite jokes from this movie was one of those needle drop moments. It's, let's see, they're all doing their thing. They, Sex Bob-omb is facing off against the two twins, and they're having that big, like, amp-to-amp battle. They literally blew the roof off the place.
Yeah.
And so, like, some snow is coming in through that hole in the roof. Scott is walking through the crowd. He passes by Knives Chow. She's looking extremely sad and dejected, and she's standing in this little, like, almost like spotlight of snow and sadness. And then the song Ode for a 17-year-old Girl starts playing by Broken Social Scene. And it's such a subtle joke, because you need to know the name of the song to know that it's talking about Knives Chow in that moment.
Yeah.
And then they don't call attention to it. It's just a complete 1% joke. Uh-huh. And then they just keep going. And then it follows it with another one. Then they get outside, and Gideon Graves, he's kind of showing off that he is in control of Ramona. And so then playing outside the speakers of his car is Under My Thumb by the Rolling Stones.
Yeah.
it's just such fun. Like they bothered to be clever.
Yeah.
And that's kind of all I can ask of anyone, you know? It's like, I'm sitting down and giving you my time. Are you grateful for my time, and you're going to bother to actually think about this and give me back something that's clever and fun, you
yeah.
know?
Yeah, and the attention to detail and just the density of his movies is really, like, he's not phoning it in, man. Like, it's really, it makes you respect him. Like, you love the movies, but you also really respect him as a filmmaker, because he does care about that thing and about the, you know, the 500 people who know that Broken Social Scene song title.
Yeah.
And I've got some of my favorite lines here too. It's, and little stuff. I mean, Michael Cera is so great. Like, the cast is just unbelievable in this movie. But
this feels like the role
so
he was
endearing.
Like born to play.
Yeah.
from what I've heard, basically, Edgar Wright was a huge fan of Arrested Development, like we all were in the early 2000s.
Yeah.
And when he saw him, he was like, he had just gotten the rights to make the movie. And so he was like, oh, man, if Michael Cera was just a little bit older, he would be this perfect Scott Pilgrim.
Yeah.
Then, of course, the movie went into production hell and it got delayed by like 5 years.
Yeah, perfect.
And then, yeah, he was like, oh, perfect. I can have my first choice now. He has aged into it.
Well, and of course, Mae Whitman, she was from Arrested Development, and she plays Roxy. She's got a lot of funny lines in this movie, actually, because she's kind of dumb and says things wrong. But you punched me in the boob, prepare to die, obviously. That's a great line from her. And then, what was the other one? Oh, here. And this is such a great dumb joke, but it gets me every single time. I literally laugh out loud. Your BF is about to get effed in the B.
Yes. So simple. So
I know. I'm a sucker for wordplay like that. And there's a lot of great wordplay in the movie and a lot of really subtle lines for Michael Cera, because he's so low key, whether or not he's saying, she's America, instead of she's American, just like little bitty jokes like that, or break out the L word, lesbian, the other L word, lesbians. Big Kieran Culkin fan too.
He was
fantastic.
He was perfect in this. It was, I mean, obviously everyone loves Macaulay, but you know, watch more Igby Goes Down and watch this movie and you're going to love Kieran. You know?
He's the best. I love Igby Goes Down is one of my favorites too. Brandon Routh was very surprisingly funny. I did not know he had it in him, but that was one of the funnier sequences was him. And then, of course, Thomas Jane is part of the vegan police.
Yes.
Very, very funny stuff. You punch the highlights. He punched the highlights out of her hair. Here's two more favorite lines. If I peed my pants, would you pretend I just got wet from the rain? That's like a great song lyric or something. And then Kim has a great line too, and says something about a secret. Can we play a secret show? And she just throws it in there. All our shows are secret shows. And it moves so fast. You know, there's so many lines coming at you. There are these little quick insert lines, especially from Kim, these little asides that that just really, really hit home in the best way. Allison Pill is great.
Oh, just so good. Well, one of my favorite gifts that I've used for the past 10 years, is the one of Allison Pill bringing her fingers up to her head as if she's going to shoot herself in the head, squeeze the trigger, and then the word bang comes out the other side and she falls down. I use that gif far too often, but it's so perfect.
Well, and everyone has a nice little arc too. You can make a movie like this that's fun and kind of batshit crazy and visually just bonkers, but you have to have good story and good character arcs. And everyone has one, you know. I feel like Knives has one. Mm-hmm. I feel like Kim has one. She gets her little moment at the end where there's an understanding between she and Scott when he apologized to her. Ramona certainly does. Scott does. I think Julie, Aubrey Plaza's Julie, never really, I mean, she's great in the movie, but she doesn't have much of an arc.
No. you're absolutely right. It also, to me, just feels good. Like, I know it actually has a lot in common with the movie did last week, Still Crazy.
Yeah.
Because it's a music-centric, band-related, et cetera, et cetera. And I would wonder, I know you and I both play music. I would wonder people who have never been in a band and like never gone to those dive venues and never done those kind of just like, to me, like essential parts of my childhood and my life, if it would strike as like close to the heart as it does with people like you and I.
Yeah.
I would like to think so, because I can watch, you know, Remember the Titans, and I know that it's a good film, despite the fact that I didn't play football.
Right, yeah.
But I don't know if perhaps it was a world you needed to live to feel its authenticity. Like, I don't know. But I do know that, like, that feeling of playing music with friends and like being in sync with one another and actually creating something larger than yourself with this group of people, It feels good when you're doing it. And I think watching this movie makes you feel that feeling as well. And it's just a good feeling. It feels happy.
Yeah, I totally agree. And the band stuff really works. Like we already said, the music was great, but they look the part. They pull it off. It feels like, I didn't look it up, but is the guy who plays Stephen Stills, is he really singing that stuff?
He is, yeah.
Okay, I figured he was.
All of the band had to learn their instruments except for Michael Cera. Michael Cera already knew how to play bass.
Okay.
But the other members all had to learn it and then do it for real.
Yeah, it comes across. And now that you say that Beck wrote the songs, it makes a lot more sense. They sound a little Becky. That sort of beater acoustic guitar makes more sense now.
Yeah.
I like that effect of that sort of beat up acoustic that's run through a distortion pedal.
For
and
sure,
like a power
for sure.
amp, like that's not something people do generally in a band, but it's got a cool sound to it.
What you should look up when we're done here is there are versions you can hear of Beck performing his songs that he wrote for Sex Bomb.
Yeah.
They're wonderful. Really good stuff.
Yeah, I've seen, as I'm sure you have, I've seen Beck a bunch of times over the years. And I always tell people, you got to go see Beck. And even if people are like, well, I sort of just like him. And I'm like, just go see him live. He's like it's a weird comparison, but if you see him live, you get it. He's like the James Brown of our time.
Oh, definitely.
I mean, you see him live.
Dance moves aside, because he has some killer dance moves that I've tried to replicate my whole life and never once come close to, but he pulls them off effortlessly, you know?
Yeah, and just what he's been doing for the past, like, 15 years with doing stuff like Sea Change and Morning Phase, which are two of my favorite albums of all time by anybody.
For sure.
But then coming back and doing something like, was the album Colors, the one
two albums ago, right? Just right, like, before Hyperspace, yeah.
Yeah, and Hyperspace, both just like serious party albums.
Yeah.
And he's just sort of floating in between these worlds, and that band that he plays with live is just so fucking kick-ass. They're able to just seamlessly kind of go back and forth. When they did, you know, sort of the Sea Change Morning Phase stuff, it was like they had been replaced by different people. They were just so lithe and able to bounce around between, because he's a genre hopper anyway, you know, that's what he's always done. But boy, it was just so, so great to see him live. I can't wait to go see live music again.
No, I
we're all
100%
suffering.
Agree. I still have a big pile of concert tickets and bracelets from festivals just sitting around my house that I couldn't go to, obviously, that I just can't bear to throw away.
Oh, tickets you had?
Yes.
Yeah.
Like I had some Noise Pop festival things. I had Big Ears up in Tennessee. I had a whole bunch of tickets for I live right here by the Earl, so I go to the Earl on a regular basis.
Yeah,
well, I went to the Earl on a regular basis.
Yeah.
And I have some shaky knees stuff. And it's just like, yeah, I can't throw it away, because it's like, I don't know, almost like admitting that it's gone. It's never going to happen again. I don't know.
No, I'm with you. I had a couple of big show tickets. I had the Guns N' Roses at Grant Field. I had tickets for that.
Yeah.
And that didn't happen. And then I had tickets for Roger Waters. I had really good seats for Roger Waters, and I was so looking forward to that. And, you know, hopefully he'll come back.
I mean, you know, with all the news of vaccines, I'm much more optimistic today than I was a week ago, you know?
No, totally. Yeah. Absolutely.
A new season of Bridgerton is here. And with it, a new season of Bridgerton, the official podcast. I'm your host, Gabrielle Collins, and this season, we are bringing fans even deeper into the ton. Colin Bridgerton has returned from his travels abroad. Is betrothal written in the stars for the eligible bachelor? Meanwhile, the ton is reverberating with speculation of who holds Lady Whistledown's pen. We're discussing it all. I sit down with Nicola Coughlan, Luke Newton, Shonda Rhimes, and more to offer an exclusive peek behind the scenes of each episode of the new season. Watch season 3 of the Shondaland series on Netflix. Then, fall in love all over again by listening to Bridgerton, the official podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe to catch a new episode every Thursday.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher. I'm so excited to tell you about the brand new series of The Girlfriends. In season 1, we told you about the murder of Gail Katz at the hands of my ex-boyfriend, Bob. At one point, a woman's torso washed up on Staten Island and was misidentified as Gail. She spent 9 years in Gail's grave, and then she just disappeared.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
And that's what we're going to do. Find this missing girlfriend and tell her story. With the help of some of your favorite girlfriends from season 1, like my producer, Anna.
Oh my God.
My friend, Dr. Mindy Shapiro.
Hi, it's Dr. Shapiro, and I'd like to speak with the deputy medical examiner.
And of course, Gail's sister, Elaine Katz.
Having no closure, it kills you.
Join us as we try to solve a 35-year-old cold case. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be one hell of a ride.
What?
I can't believe this.
Listen to season 2 of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Elliot Connie, and this is Family Therapy.
My best hopes, I guess, identify the life that I want and work towards it.
I never seen a man take care of my mother the way she needed to be taken care of.
I get the impression that you don't feel like you've done everything right as a father. Is that true?
That's true, and I'm not offended by that.
Thank you for going through those things, and thank you for overcoming them.
Thank God for deliverance.
Every time I have one of our sessions be positive. It just keeps me going.
I feel like my focus is redirected in a different aspect of my life now.
So, how'd we do today?
We did good.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy. Listen now on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Chris Evans pops into the movie. Just Chris Evans as Lucas Lee. And he has that. I mean, that's one of the funniest sequences in the movie, I think, because he's so perfect for that part. Skateboarding onto the set. That one line where the stunt doubles come out and he goes, sometimes I let him do the wide shots when I feel like getting Blaze back in my Winnie. He's so great. I mean, he's just a national treasure, man. Everything that guy does is perfect, I think.
Oh yeah. No, and it's fun to see him being himself too. Cause I remember relatively early on in his success of his career, he would still do things like show up on like Doug Loves Movies and stuff like that all the time. Uh-huh. And it's like, yeah, good for you, buddy. Like, yeah, you're just a likable guy and you're playing that role in life as well as in movies. And we all appreciate it.
He seems like a totally cool dude. I'm kind of mad at him because of like how handsome and perfect he is while also being super cool and up for anything.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm looking for the cracks.
There should be something, but... Yeah, there's those John Hamm people in the world where you're just like, come on, be bad at something. I don't know. Be missing a hand. I don't know. Yeah. Something.
Yeah. I met John Hamm once very briefly and I wanted to kiss him.
Yes, of course. Of course.
I wanted to kiss that sweet, handsome face. Mm-hmm. There was another very funny, very quick, subtle joke. Another great example, how Edgar Wright just like, it's just overstuffed with little quick lines that you got to see this movie a few times to really kind of get everything. But when Chris Evans is grinding that rail on the skateboard, and then that's really funny, super long, long lens shot where he just burst into flames at the bottom. And
very Wile E. Coyote. Yeah.
The first thing you hear is, well, that's a wrap, everybody, in the background.
It's fantastic. And I feel like Edgar Wright has done this again and again. Yeah. And I'm up for it every time. Like the jokes from his Cornetto trilogy, Shaun of the Dead, Hot Fuzz, and the one I always get confused with all the other movies about the end of the world.
Right.
The end of the world, the world's end, at world's end.
I think that's it. That's the only one I haven't seen. I still haven't seen that one.
It's solid. I mean, it's of course it is. You know, it's got all the great players.
Yeah.
But just think about how dense and structured Hot Fuzz and Shaun of the Dead are. Like, they're perfection. Every single little off comment comes back in the end. Yeah. And like, it just all pays off. It's all so funny. Edgar Wright really is a treasure. Like I don't know if he gets enough credit for what he does.
He doesn't. I feel like he's one of those guys that's working he's leveled up and he's working on a different plane than a lot of other filmmakers. Mm-hmm. Like what's going on inside his brain to be able to make any of his movies or to be able to visualize and storyboard a Baby Driver or a Scott Pilgrim or any of them. They're just, it's really, really impressive stuff. And it feels effortless. They're just so easy to watch.
Yeah, no. Like for example, you know, there's when you were asking me which movie to pick.
Yeah,
there's a big difference between what you think is the best movie and what you consider a favorite movie, as I'm sure most people do. Like,
yeah, absolutely.
If someone were to ask me, what do I think is the best movie? I'd probably say The Master, the Paul Thomas Anderson.
Oh,
one.
Yeah, yeah.
Just, you know, the acting, the decisions, the mastery of every single medium being delivered into like a solid chunk. I mean, The Master is probably the best movie.
Yeah.
But how often do I watch it? Not that often. Yeah, I can watch Scott Pilgrim with ease. Uh-huh. It's a nice, you know, warm cup of tea in the morning. It's perfect, you know?
Yeah. And it's one of those that back when I had cable and you would just flip around, you can watch any part of it for 15 or 20 minutes. And that is 15 or 20 minutes of your life that you're not going to want back, you know?
Definitely.
You can jump in there and just appreciate any part of this movie. Jason Schwartzman, unbelievable. One of my favorite actors.
You want to hear a funny thing about Jason Schwartzman in this?
I'd love to know.
I don't know if this story is public. A friend of mine knew him and, or still does know him. I don't know him. And from this friend, he told me, he was like, oh man, Jason's really excited about this movie because this is going to be his first big blockbuster. And I'm like, what? No. Obviously, he's been in tons of big blockbusters. He's like, oh, think again. Like, think about every movie Jason Schwartzman has done pre-Scott Pilgrim. And I'm like,
yeah,
very popular films, beloved, cult classics. Uh-huh. But never like a blockbuster. So he's
Rushmore wasn't some huge movie.
No, none of his films have been. They've all been great, of course. I love Jason Schwartzman. But this was going to be his big breakout. Like, this was going to be his big studio film. I'm an all-star now. And so what's funny was after the movie came out, I was like, oh, have you spoken to Jason? Did you find out? He's really excited. He's like, no. I'm like, why? He's like, it flopped. I'm like, it didn't flop. He's like, no, it flopped. I'm like, no, it's a great movie. It's really good. Like, everyone loves it, but it flopped. And I'm still baffled by that, but whatever, you know.
Yeah, I feel like it's definitely a movie that has had a tremendous second life post theatrical run. And you know, that happens. It's just one of those things where, whether it was back in the VHS days or DVD or now streaming, where a movie can just, I don't know, maybe it's timing. Because it is strange how that many people can love this movie, because I feel like it is a very beloved movie. Mm-hmm. But maybe, I mean, I know that I didn't even really know much about the comic at all going in. Like, so when it came out in the theaters, it wasn't something that grabbed my attention, like, oh my God, the Scott Pilgrim movie is out.
Right. So yeah, I guess it does come down to marketing. That's always such a dangerous
tool. This is
a tough
movie to market.
Yeah.
Admittedly.
Yeah, 100%.
Ellen Wong as Knives Chow. Mm-hmm. So cute, so endearing. This movie does a thing where it kind of leaves you guessing up until the very end. Like, and not only guessing on what's going to happen, but I think makes you conflicted as a viewer of whether or not who you want Scott to be with. Like, you're kind of going back and forth between Ramona, Mary Elizabeth Winstead, who is fantastic, and like, you know, like every person who ever saw this movie has like a huge crush on her after this.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
That cool hair and just like her, like aloof persona, like every guy in the world is just like, oh my God, it's like my dream girl, you know, cause, we all want to be hurt, I think deep down. But, even watching it today, I was like, do I want him to be with Ramona or Knives? Knives is great.
Yeah. Oh, well, did you know that there is an alternate ending to this film where he ends up with Knives?
Really?
Yes,
it's
on the DVD and the Blu-ray. And yeah, well, because from what I have heard, basically, because there are, I think, six books in the actual series. Only the first two were finished.
Okay.
When the first draft of the script was written.
Oh.
So I know Brian Lee O'Malley, the guy that wrote the comics and drew the comics, he was very involved just because Edgar Wright really wanted to involve him. So I'm sure he got all kinds of notes from Brian Lee O'Malley, like, oh, where do you think the story's going, et cetera, et cetera. But that's also, it makes a lot of sense if you read the comics and watch the movie, where it's got kind of a Game of Thrones syndrome, where like clearly the ones where they are basing it on the book, it's real stretched out and you got tons of time and energy spent there. Because think about it, like the first three Evil X's take up like, oh, I don't know, 3/4 of the movie.
Yeah.
And then like the last few are in rapid succession all at the end.
Yeah, yeah.
That's because those books weren't written yet.
Oh, interesting.
So those stories hadn't been fleshed out and there wasn't anything there. Like, so for example, you can tell the timeline of the movie by Ramona's hair, because Ramona says she changes her hair every week and a half.
Yeah, that's right.
So it changes three times. So it's approximately 4 weeks.
Right.
You know, that's what we know. In the books,
I didn't even think about that.
It takes place over a year in the books.
Oh, really?
So you see so much more of their lives. Uh-huh. You see Scott getting a job. You see Ramona, like, you know, going back and forth on how she feels about Scott. Uh-huh. You know what I mean? Like, it's like this real growth. You see Knives turn 18. Like, all these things happen in the books. And so it kind of makes one thing, which is like the reason why they're all kind of like as dedicated to each other as they feel like they are in the movie. It makes a little more sense in the book because it's kind of like you know, it unfolds more slowly and realistically, you know?
Yeah, but it didn't suffer from it, I don't think.
Me either. Especially because, like, at that age, infatuation is so strong.
Yeah, that, like, totally. It feels very real.
Absolutely. I fully agree. but back to the alternate ending with Knives Chow.
Yeah.
It's fascinating because it makes just as much sense, like you were saying. Mm-hmm. Like it really does feel... Because ultimately, it's the same scene, but instead of him walking off with Ramona, Ramona goes, you know, you two really were good together.
Yeah.
And then Ramona walks off alone and those two walk off together, you know?
That almost feels like the more natural ending to this movie because Ramona is a loner.
Yeah.
She has a hard time committing. It's probably, Knives is probably the better choice.
I mean, Scott's really immature, so maybe he should be with someone about 5 years younger than him.
Maybe so. It is kind of funny what a big deal they make about that at the beginning. That, you know, she's 17. And he's, what, I guess, like 22?
Yeah, he's 22. Yeah.
The actor who plays her, though, Ellen Wong, I'm not sure how old.
Oh, she was 25 when she filmed this.
Yeah, I knew she was a little bit older because she's 35 now. Like, she's older than Brie Larson by four or 5 years.
Yeah.
She's apparently, young face, though.
Oh, yeah, for sure. A lot of the actors swapped up their ages a lot. Like, for example, Anna Kendrick is actually older than Michael Cera, but plays his little sister.
Right.
There's apparently several things like that. But, you know, they're all around that 20s age.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Anna Kendrick is also just in this movie for a minute or two.
Yeah.
And Brie Larson, just a little actor named Brie Larson. I mean, granted, she's blown up since then.
Yeah.
But when you look at the cast, it's really, really pretty astonishing.
I mean, basically everyone is an all-star in this. Like, even the people where I don't know their names, I still really like them in other movies. Like the guy that plays young Neil, he was really wonderful in Jennifer's Body. Did you ever see that movie?
Oh, totally.
Yeah. And just like dumb stuff like that, where it's just like, oh yeah, no, that's a great actor. That's a great actor. That's a great actor. Like, they're all good. You know, there's no weak chain on this movie at all. Everyone's perfect in what they're doing.
Yeah, and I feel like he sort of he broke some of these people. I mean,
oh, for sure. Yeah.
Some of them were in other movies, but like I said, Brie Larson wasn't that huge then. Anna Kendrick had yet to kind of really blow up, I think, at that point.
Yeah, this was pre-Twilight, pre-Pitch Perfect. So yeah.
The guy, like you were talking about, young Neil, Johnny Simmons, he has another very, very quick little joke that is so easy to miss. Early on in the Battle of the Bands, when he is side stage singing, he's singing along with the band, and I'm sure you know what I'm talking about.
Yes,
and
I love it.
He goes, oh no, instead of saying, oh my.
Yeah.
And he does that thing where everyone's done it, where you mess up a word, and he goes, oh no, and then he goes, my.
Yes. Because I do think there's something very instinctual in all of us when we go see a concert, that inside our bodies, we want to feel like we're involved.
Yeah.
And that's why we sing along. That's why we clap along. That's why we dance along. And then those moments happen where you think something's happening, but you're obviously wrong. And you're quickly reminded and embarrassed by the fact that, oh, wait, I'm not involved.
Yeah, you're not a part of this.
I'm not, my contribution is not a part of what's making this great. I only feel that on the inside.
Yeah. Although, you know, and you know this too, and I know this isn't what you meant, but I've been to shows where the crowd has clearly taken things up a notch.
Yeah. I went to
the one that most recently that I'm thinking of, and even had him on Movie Crush, was Albert Hammond Jr. Played at Terminal West here. And it was, you know, I mean, I'll go to a show any night of the week, but there's something about a Friday night show.
Right.
People have gotten off work. It's the beginning of the weekend. They're always better. People are partying a little harder and it's just a little bit more intense. But he played on a Friday night on his last time through town. And it was just unbelievable how much more energy that show had because of the crowd, and you could sense it in the band. And he even said something. He was like, what is going on in Atlanta tonight? And he was like, this is amazing. And you could tell they were feeding off of it. And I talked to him afterward and I was like, that seemed like a great show. And I always, whenever I have the few times I've been able to like meet and know a musician and go backstage and stuff, I'm always like, was that a good show? Like, 'cause it felt great, but what do you think? Mm-hmm. And the same thing happened to a Dr. Dog show I went to. Both times, they were like, yeah, dude, that was one of the best shows on the tour so far. And you can tell, you know, it's infectious.
I had one of those moments last year, obviously pre-COVID. Slater Kinney was playing here in town, and actually me and Noel went together to that show.
Oh, cool.
And obviously, as I'm sure you can tell from getting to know me now, Noel and I are very similar people. I like Noel a lot. He's a great dude. So we went to this show, and
I wanted to go to that show.
Yeah, it was great. It was really great. And then Carrie Brownstein was up front because she was singing her song, Modern Girl. Mm-hmm. And the audience was singing along with such fervor and like ferocity along with her that she broke down into tears towards the end of the song.
Are you kidding me?
And it was just such a beautiful moment, you know, of just to like have her experience the love back in real time. It's great stuff.
So cool.
Music's the greatest, which is, I think, what makes this movie so great.
Here's a little fun fact. Corinne Tucker is and her whole family are big Stuff You Should Know fans.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's wonderful.
She's cool. I've met her, and I know her husband Lance a little bit, and she's actually going to be in conversation with Josh and I on one of our virtual book tour stops.
Nice.
And she is just super nice and a wonderful, wonderful human being. So she is exactly how you would think she would be.
That's perfection. That's all I want from her. And I'm happy it's true.
And great family too. They're just wonderful people. Another little quick joke. When she's going through the tea selection so fast, Ramona in her apartment, liver disaster.
Yes. I always think twice about liver disaster because some of those are teas that I genuinely drink in my real life. Yeah. I genuinely drink sleepy time tea pretty often. Yeah, I love it. So yeah, liver disaster.
Well, I'm sure you've had throat coat if you, do you sing?
Yes. Yeah. And yeah, you gotta keep, I have a cup of peppermint Bigelow tea right here next to me just in case I need it.
Nice. I had some English breakfast tea this morning.
Oh, nice.
I also wanted to comment too on like how good the music is really evidenced in that little acoustic Ramona song that Michael Cera in the movie, Scott Pilgrim writes for her.
Yeah.
That's such a great little chord progression. Mm-hmm. There's something about it. It's, it feels sort of Frank Blackie and sort of Pixies-esque, but, did Beck do that? Do you know?
He did. Yes. Yeah.
There's something about that chord sequence that just gets me.
There's a full length version of it on the soundtrack. That's wonderful. Yeah. Really good stuff. But you're absolutely right. Like there's this X factor in music that a lot of people have kind of like talked about before. But when you get it right, it just feels so right.
Yeah.
And I wonder, do you know about the whole thing of aesthetic bliss for Zahn? Have you ever thought about that before?
No.
But more or less, and this is, I'm nowhere near smart enough to know the science behind this, but for Zahn is the feeling when you're listening to music or watching a movie and you get the chills go up your spine.
Oh, yeah. Okay? Sure.
And it's a French term and it translates to aesthetic bliss.
Okay.
And I'm a person who experiences that often, music especially, like when a certain chorus kicks in or a certain like change happens, like I'll get that often. I get those chills from this movie like 5 or 6 times.
Yeah.
Like there are just so many moments that feel so right.
Yeah.
I think it's the music. I think the music and the tone of music and the feeling of music. And I think anyone who's a music fan just feels a part of it. And I guess it's kind of like the singing along thing where it's like, I'm a part of this. I'm involved, you know?
Yeah, it makes you want to go grab your guitar and learn that chord sequence. I was trying to follow along, but I'll hear the song later and I'll get out my guitar and I will start playing that Ramona song.
Totally.
It's so great. And you know how they fused the music and the video game stuff and fantasy and reality in the movie, how it's, it's definitely a fantasy film in a lot of ways, but it's also grounded in that, you know, when Scott's doing these fights, his sister is just looking like, what the fuck is he doing? Like, how does he know how to do that? And it just sort of dances between these worlds very deftly. And it's a bit of a miracle of a movie, I think, to be able to pull this off. It was very risky and it could have gone wrong a lot of times and it just never did.
There's a couple of things about what you just said. First of all, that moment, which is wonderful with Anna Kendrick, when he's doing the first fight in the club. And Matthew Patel comes in, that's 30 minutes into the film before we get our first fight scene. Like that is gutsy. And I really, really appreciate that. Because it's kind of like a From Dusk Till Dawn kind of thing. Uh-huh. Where you're like, oh, okay, we're having a heist movie. Vampires, you know?
Yeah. If you don't know the story, it feels just like a really kind of fun, interesting romantic comedy with a different spin on it. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden at that first plot point, that act break, you know what's going to happen. As he's got to, all of a sudden the stakes are there. He's got to fight these evil exes. And that's when the movie just kind of goes up again. It levels up, to use a video game term.
And I think that moment with Anna Kendrick, when she just goes like, what?
Yeah.
And you just, I think she's reflecting the audience there, where you acknowledge that the film has acknowledged that this is confusing. You know?
Yeah, absolutely. I love everything about it. It's a movie that I want to see a sequel for. I don't know if that is a thing or not.
Not really in the books, because the books wrapped up there. So I would love it too. Yeah, I want that. Maybe we'll get lucky, you know?
Well, I'm reading now. It says Edgar Wright has revealed he's in tentative stages of planning a new, possibly animated project with the original material, but a big screen sequel is unlikely.
Hmm. Well, I'll take anything.
Yeah, no, totally. That would still be a lot of fun. Huh. I mean, everyone's a little old now. I don't. Michael Cera, he's probably too old to play Scott, isn't he?
I mean, unless they did that thing where the film jumps forward in time,
right?
You know, like did you ever read the graphic novel for Fight Club 2?
No, I heard about that though.
It's really interesting, and the way that they accomplish it is basically they jump forward in time, because obviously that if the story continued right where they left off, it would more or less be the same. But they jumped forward to they're married, they have a kid, et cetera, et cetera.
Oh, interesting.
And so then it is much more of like what could be happening? Let's catch up. Almost like 7-Up style, you know? So that's something. In the regard to like this movie being just like so strange structurally and being kind of a fantasy and kind of all these things, I heard Edgar Wright say this thing once where basically he considered this film to be a musical, except instead of breaking into songs, they broke into fights.
That's great.
Makes sense.
Yeah,
you know?
That's fantastic.
I feel that, because especially, you know, like in most musicals, there's no reason for them to break into song. It just kind of happens at like a heightened point of emotion.
Uh-huh.
Same thing. There's no real reason for these fights to break out.
Yeah.
But in the logic of the world, it makes sense, you know?
Yeah. Well, dude, I feel like we could keep talking, but I have to go get my daughter from school. So unfortunately, we have to cut this short. But I think, Seth, you have worked your way into the regular rotation if you're up for it.
Anytime you need me, that's what I'm here for.
Sweet, man. That's awesome. This is a lot of fun. It's good to get to know you.
You as well.
I'm glad the listeners have gotten to know you a little bit. And, you know, whether you like it or not, you're going to start coming on like every, you know, 6 or 7 weeks, maybe.
You got it.
Sounds great, buddy. Thanks a lot.
Movie Crush is produced and written by Charles Bryant and Noel Brown, edited and engineered by Seth Nicholas Johnson, and scored by Noel Brown here in our home studio at Ponce de Market, Atlanta, Georgia, for iHeartRadio.
For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
A new season of Bridgerton is here. And with it, a new season of Bridgerton, the official podcast. I'm your host, Gabby Collins. And this season, we are bringing fans even deeper into the ton. Watch season 3 of the Shondaland series on Netflix. Then fall in love all over again by listening to Bridgerton, the official podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe to catch a new episode every Thursday.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher, back with another season of the global number one podcast, The Girlfriends. Last time, we investigated the murder of Gail Katz. This time, we're uncovering the identity of the woman who was buried in Gail's grave for a decade before she disappeared. Join me and the rest of the club as we tell her story. Listen to season 2 of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Michael Rappaport.
And I'm Kibi Rappaport.
And together we're hosting Rappaport's Reality Podcast.
We have a passion for reality TV, and we're inviting you into our living room.
We're dissecting the drama, and we're giving praise to the single greatest form of entertainment on television today. That is right. Reality TV is the greatest form of entertainment on television today.
Listen to Rappaport's Reality with me, Kibi Rappaport.
And me, Michael Rappaport, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.